Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is David Hill, author of the new book called The Vapors, A Southern Family, The New York Mob, and The Rise and Fall of Hot Springs, America's Forgotten Capital of Vice. David Hill, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, guys.
I don't think I knew that Hot Springs, Arkansas was a gambling resort that was actually larger than Las Vegas for much of the 20th century. So the book was opened up my eyes. So David, tell us in about 10 or 15 minutes what the book is about. Then we're going to ask you some questions, and then we're going to ask about a lot of the other things you've written as well.
Sure. So the book traces the lives of three people through a period of time that spans from about 1931 to 1968. Those three people are Oney Madden, who was a pretty well-known gangster from New York who ran the Cotton Club, managed a lot of boxers, and was one of the crime lords of New York City through Prohibition, and ends up coming to Hot Springs after a prison stint to sort of get away from New York. And a man named Dane Harris, who is the son of a Cherokee bootlegger, a local Arkansas boy who kind of rises up and becomes the boss gambler of the town. And my grandmother, who came to Hot Springs with her father as a teenager, her father was a horse trainer who traveled the horse racing circuit. And she stays in Hot Springs, marries and starts a family and lives there, sort of dealing in the casinos and working as a shill player. And so I follow these three people's lives that through that period of time, they all sort of intersected this one club called The Vapors that opened in 1960 in Arkansas. And I mean, you said it before, Hot Springs is interesting because it had this sort of outsized role in the gambling business in America for a long period of time. For a number of those years, I would say it was bigger than Las Vegas just because Las Vegas was a bit of a, you know, there wasn't much to Vegas in the 1920s and 30s yet. But the reason that Hot Springs kind of grows relative to other illegal gambling towns around the country, like Fort Worth or New Orleans or
Newport,
Palm
Kentucky.
Springs, Newport is a perfect one, Phoenix City, Alabama. The reason, or even Cook County, Illinois, the reason Hot Springs grows larger than these cities is that throughout the 1950s and there was a series of, there was the Kefauver Senate Committee's hearings that they took around the road to try to take on the mob and take on the illegal gambling business in America. And every town they went to, they shut down, you know, there'd be sort of a movement of reform in their wake. And that was followed by the McClellan Committee that carried that work on into the 1960s. And then Robert Kennedy as Attorney General carried it even further with the laws that he passed. So those efforts shut down all the illegal gambling businesses all over America, except for Hot Springs. Hot Springs was the last man standing, so to speak. And so once we get into the 1960s, the Hot Springs was really a big operation. And what I write about in the book is how, you know, after the revolution in Cuba, the mob really had to figure out what they were going to do with their money and their investments that they had really been on Cuba. And there was a moment where there was some interest in it being Hot Springs versus Las Vegas. Las Vegas had the advantage of it being legal. Efforts to legalize gambling in Hot Springs failed, and a number of other sort of things that were going on in the town that I read about in the book. So it's sort of the town that could have been, right? I mean, if not for a couple of votes here or a couple of people getting killed over here, maybe you guys would be talking to me from Hot Springs and not Las Vegas today. And that would be the city that was the international tourist destination.
You know, that is exactly what I was thinking as I read the book. And I really kind of found it sad that Hot Springs, A, it had the benefits of being better weather. It's in right. The center of the country. And it was already a resort destination because of the hot springs. And man, what Arkansas could have been if they didn't screw it up, you know, by the religious right sort of, you know, making sure that the gambling ended up being made illegal. And, you know, I mean, Arkansas really had a hard time recovering from that because it really was the big cash cow for the state.
It was pretty massive. And I mean, for the town of Hot Springs, it was the entire economy. You know, Hot Springs is a national park. A lot of people don't know that. It's the smallest national park in America. And a lot of people have been to Saratoga Springs in New York, which is a bit of a like bizarro world Hot Springs. It's like a Hot Springs where people have money, because Hot Springs today is a relatively, you know, poor community, especially compared to a place like Saratoga. But it's the same type of evolution, right? It was like a bit of a spa town, you know, hot water bathhouses, like natural spring bathhouses, which were very much in vogue in the first part of the century because people thought they actually had medicinal qualities, right? So people would come from all over the world to take these baths on doctor's orders. And so that brought in a lot of tourists on its own. But Hot Springs, you know, it was, I think you said it well already, like it was so well set up to be the recipient of the mob's hundreds of millions of dollars and investment capital, and Las Vegas wasn't. I mean, Meyer Lansky famously hated Las Vegas. He didn't like going there. You know, he thought it was miserable. And even during that period of time where this sort of arms race or whatever is going on, you know, Las Vegas doesn't have any working sewers. You know, there's only one paved road. You know, like Las Vegas really was, I imagine if we were alive then, it would have been very hard probably to stand in Las Vegas and imagine it becoming what it is today. But it wouldn't have been that hard to stand in Hot Springs at that same period of time, a place where there were already massive hotels built, a place where there was already all this infrastructure to support this. So it's hard now looking at these two cities to think Hot Springs could have been that. But I imagine if we were back then, if we were standing back, we went back in time and stood there, we would have thought there's no way in hell that this little town in the middle of a desert could ever be, you know, I mean, I think people would have thought you were nuts if you showed them what Las Vegas would turn into.
Yeah.
Richard mentioned the Southern Baptist had a large part of putting down Hot Springs, yeah, which is true, but Estes Kefauver and McClellan and Robert Kennedy would have done their damnedest to put it down, Southern Baptist or no Southern Baptist. So it was more the government who put it down than the religious right, isn't it?
Well, the story I tell in the book and what my research sort of uncovered was that the reason Hot Springs outlived all these other cities that Kefauver and McClellan shut down was because of Hot Springs' connections to both of those senators. And so Estes Kefauver, even though he was a senator from Tennessee, he grew up in Hot Springs. He was a high school. He didn't grow up there, but he came there as a young man right out of college, and he taught high school in Hot Springs in the 1920s. And he was a gambling addict. He had massive gambling debts. He gambled a lot at the track. And later, as a senator, while he was sort of on the road, the story that Meyer Lansky's daughter tells in her book is that the reason Meyer Lansky was never called to testify before the Kefauver hearings was because when they were going to subpoena him, he came to Hot Springs and got Onimadin to go around to all the local gamblers in Hot Springs and sort of put together a dossier on all the markers that Kefauver had left behind when he was there, and all of his running around and dirty dealings he had in Hot Springs. And Meyer Lansky brought that file with him when he met with Kefauver on it behind, you know, closed doors to say, hey, this, you know, because Kefauver wanted to run for president. So he used this as a sort of blackmail to keep himself from being subpoenaed. And the same with McClellan. I found FBI wiretaps that showed that the gamblers in Hot Springs were buying Senator McClellan cars. They were, you know, they were giving him money. I mean, he was definitely on the take. This was the senator, you know, McClellan was from Arkansas. He was the Arkansas senator, and he was the chair of the committee that followed Kefauver. And he caught a lot of hell from a lot of people, not just from other legislators, but gangsters. You know, there's a lot of interesting FBI wiretaps from around the country where gangsters are furious. They're complaining about, why are they doing a hearing in my town when McClellan's own state is like the biggest gambling town going on right now? So this was a thing that people were discussing in all the papers about how McClellan was turning a blind eye to Arkansas. And it was true. He really was. He never held a hearing in Arkansas. He would dodge the question whenever people would ask him, why are you not holding hearings in Arkansas? Eventually, they did bring Onimadin up before the committee. And then Onimadin after he testified, he sort of he closed down the wire, which is what he ran in Hot Springs. But at that point, Oney knew that the wire was going to be shut down anyway because of Bobby Kennedy's Wire Act that he was about to pass. So at that point, it was like, I think Madden knew, was sort of smart enough to know, might as well get out while the getting's good and allow McClellan to save face. So no, I think the reason Hot Springs outlived all these towns was because of political corruption. And what ended it in 1968 was that when Rockefeller got elected governor, this guy's a Republican. He's the first Republican to get elected office in Arkansas since Reconstruction. He came down from New York to Arkansas to get a divorce from his wife because Arkansas and Nevada back then were the only two states where you could get a quickie divorce. And he stayed and decided to run for governor against Faubus. And Faubus is a well-known political figure. You know, he was the governor of Arkansas that was sort of an ardent segregationist who, you know, used the National Guard to keep the Little Rock Central High School from integrating. And Baptists hated that he supported gambling. He was sort of on the take as well, and he allowed gambling going on in Hot Springs. And Baptists that were to his right, that were sort of more racist than him, challenged him in primaries, primary after primary, basically saying that he was too soft on civil rights, which is hard to imagine given that Bob has placed this, like, you know, diabolical role in civil rights history. They said he was too liberal in civil rights and he was supporting gambling and booze in Hot Springs. And it was that political pressure that finally gave, you know, Faubus, you know, pushed Faubus to stop supporting gambling in Arkansas. And that was the sort of, that was the domino that set everything. So that's why it eventually shut down. But, you know, Arkansas political leaders across the state stood behind gambling longer than political leaders in other states stood behind gambling in their own. And it allowed that economy to flourish there, despite the fact that Arkansas was a very conservative, religious state outside of Hot Springs.
Well, they also almost passed a bill legalizing gambling in Arkansas, right? I mean,
right. They had several attempts, and they, you know, it would fail by one vote or fail by a couple of votes. Eventually, they passed it. So when Rockefeller became governor, the state legislature finally passed the bill to legalize it, and the story was that they had to pay $1,000 a vote to get it to pass. But they passed the bill, and Rockefeller had told some people in Hot Springs that if the bill passes, he's not going to sign it, but he's not going to veto it. He'll just, if he doesn't veto it within 5 days, it would have just taken into effect. So with that sort of green light, they went and they bought all their votes and they passed it. So the state legislature passed the bill. And on the fourth night, like minutes before it was supposed to expire, he vetoed the bill and shocked everybody. And that really took the wind out of everybody's sails. And from that point, Dane Harris, the guy write about in the book, he closes up shop and he starts running junkets. He starts a casino in Turkey and he starts running junkets to Turkey. And, you know, everybody sort of left. They went to find other businesses and other places that they could ply the gambling trade. And Hot Springs really went through a bad stretch through the 1970s and 80s because of it.
Your three major characters in the book are all dead, but who did you get to actually talk to that was still alive?
Well, I did some interviews with members of my family. The stories from my family came from some people who were alive when I was researching the book, and I was able to tape interviews with them. The book took so long to write that they passed away before it came out. But I was able to interview some of the contemporaries of my grandmother for the book. And then for Dane Harris, I spent a lot of time with his daughter, and interviewed her, plus a lot of other local folks. A lot of the people in Hot Springs that I interviewed, they were the children of the people that are in the book, you know, sort of one generation removed. And one of the things I heard over and over again as I interviewed people was, I really wish I'd asked my parents more questions. You know, like, I feel like there was a generation there that maybe didn't ask their parents questions, or their parents didn't want to tell because this stuff was all illegal and they may not have been too proud of what they were doing. And now their children, I think, don't know a lot of this stuff. So I actually I had many experiences of taking FBI files that I had FOIA'd to the children of some of the people in the book to show them and just sort of blowing people's wigs back with being able to read transcripts of their parents' conversations that, you know, telling stories that they never knew were true.
You know, it evoked the same thing in me when I moved to Vegas after college and got a job as a dealer, and I dealt with a number of guys who worked in Hot Springs and Newport, Kentucky, and places, and it just kills me that I didn't interview them back then, because I remember one guy I knew who had worked in Hot Springs told me that when he got to Vegas and he read Greenfelt Jungle, which was this expose of the mob influence on gambling, and there was this guy in the Greenfelt Jungle called Ice Pick Willie, and who would kill people by stabbing them, you know, through the eardrum with an ice pick. And he realized it was his boss at the Fremont Hotel, you know?
Yeah.
I wish I had the stories of those guys today.
Yeah, oral history is so important. And I think that we, you know, for a long time, people didn't collect these stories because historians themselves didn't really value them. For many years, historians felt like oral history is not is unreliable. You know, people tell story, you know, oral history is folklore and people make things up or they exaggerate. And the only kind of thing that really is real history is what's written down. And I think one of the things that I discovered was that I found that a lot of the stuff that was written down, especially when you're writing about crime, is just as unreliable and often is intentionally false, right? That people are intentionally writing false police reports or giving false testimony in trials or telling a journalist, you know, a lie on purpose to cover something up. And so 30, 40 years on, oral history is sometimes more reliable than the source documents that you would find, because once there's no risk of going to jail, people will tell you the truth, you know? But I agree that, like, it's sad that, like, I think some people sometimes don't even realize that the things that they lived through and went through are going to be fascinating to a future generation, and they may see their own lives as boring. And I found plenty of people that I interviewed say, oh, well, I'll let you go through, you know, my dad's stuff, but all it is a bunch of letters he wrote to his wife during the war, to my mom. I'm like, well, that'd be amazing. I'd love to read those. Oh, it's all boring. It's just, it's nothing you'd be interested in. And it's just like such a disconnect between what some people think is interesting to an outsider and what actually is interesting. And like reading somebody's actual like love letters from while they're in the war, that's such an insight into somebody's, you know, into somebody's mind. And it's such an intimate thing. That's exactly the kind of stuff that a writer would want to look at. But sure. I think people don't value some of those things. So, you know, Ice Pick Willie didn't think anybody would ever want to tell his stories. And so he, you know, wasn't too free with them.
Yeah.
All right. Or the statute of limitations hadn't run out.
We're talking to David Hill. And so we're going to take some commercial breaks. And after we get back, we're going to discuss a lot of the other writing David Hill has done about gambling and other topics. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. Spin to Win promotion kicks off every day, Monday through Thursday, 3 a.m. to 2:59 a.m. You play $2,000 coin-in video poker. You receive a free virtual spin at the machine. Players may earn up to 4 spins per day. The average spin has been worth about $12. For the first several sessions this year, I'm averaging more than that. So I don't know if this is an intentional change or just I've been running hot. I don't know. But in addition to the normal 0.3 slot club, this makes it triple points 4 days a week for the first $8,000 coin in. At predicted.org, there's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. You want to bet who's going to win the election, either nationally or who's going to take over the Senate or who's going to win in Arkansas, for that matter. You can do it, and you can play small bets and make a profit if you're correct. Gambling with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. BlackjackApprenticeship.com is an excellent site for those of you who wish to be successful at counting cards at blackjack. As of the day we're recording this, the upcoming boot camp, July 22nd to 23rd, still has at least one opening. If you're interested, call the folks at blackjackapprenticeship.com ASAP. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. There's an additional membership called the Pro Membership. It's sold separately, or you can get a combination if you already have the gold membership. Listeners can play 1,000 hands for free to try it out at videopoker.com/GWAE. The biggest advantage of this software, in my opinion, is that it accurately corrects you on all pay schedules of Ultimate X and Quick Quads. Let's go back to David Hill. David's writings, or at least much of his writings, is on the website davidhillonline.com/writing. So what kind of things will we find on that site?
Well, I mean, that's my website. I post, you know, a lot of some of my clips that I'm maybe particularly proud of there for people to read. These days I primarily write features for a place called The Ringer, which is a sports and popular culture website run by Bill Simmons. And I've been doing a lot for them most recently, but I've written for magazines. I've done stuff for radio programs, and I write a lot about gambling, which is, you know, a big part of why, I mean, I'm a gambler. I love gambling, and then that's why I love this show. And I've written quite a few features on gamblers and on topics about gambling.
You first came to my attention with a big article, about Spanky, who's been on our show a couple of times. And it was, I was like, wow, why have I never heard of this writer before when I first saw it? So, tell us, how did you get hooked up with Spanky? How did that come about?
Well, it was a bit of a tail wagging the dog kind of thing. That story was editor at The Ringer had reached out to me and asked if I had any stories about sports gambling. I mean, it just sort of was like, and he was not the first person to do that. I mean, this was last year, I think, right? And last year, everybody wanted a story about sports gambling. It was because of New Jersey, right? New Jersey had just opened up after the Supreme Court decision. And after they had started taking bets in New Jersey, like every publication in the world wanted a story. And so because I had some bylines on gambling, people were reaching out to me and saying, what kinds of stories do you have? Well, it just sort of was like kismet, because when I got this email saying, do you have any good stories on sports betting in New Jersey, I had just seen these tweets that Spanky had tweeted out with the video. You know, he had just signed up for Twitter. He had never been on Twitter before. And he got on Twitter just to go into William Hill shops and like get kicked out and to get it on video so he could show people what was going on. And so these tweets were getting retweeted, and I'd seen all these tweets and started following Spanky on Twitter. And so I said to the editor, like, I don't know, maybe I might have a story. Let me get back to you. And then I reached out to Spanky and said, you want to do a story? And Spanky was like, I don't want my name in it, right? Like, I'll talk to you, but I'll definitely talk to you. Maybe we can do something, but I want to keep my name out of it. And I said, that's totally fine. And then over the time, I spent a few months, you know, kind of hanging out with him and getting to know him. And over time, he opened up a little more and was more willing to have his name be in the story. But what really started out in the beginning as a story was just going to be kind of that same old story about, did you know that sports books, you know, won't let you bet if you win? Really turned into a story about Spanky and his life and kind of how he became a pro, because as I got to know more about his life, I realized, like, this is the real story. Like, this is so much more fascinating than just talking about the ins and outs of the sports, you know, the legal sports betting business.
I'm surprised when you said that initially you told him it was no problem not to use his name, because most magazines would never let that slide, right? And because I've run into that before, where they they say, absolutely not, we have to have a real name.
Yep, it's often true. But I guess maybe in this particular case, I had a little carte blanche. And also, like, if a place wants, if they want the story and they don't think that the person's identity is sort of crucial, then they'll allow for anonymity. In this case, I convinced Spanky to do it, and he willingly did it. So it wasn't an issue. But I wrote a story about cockfighting in Arkansas, actually, that was on the face of it, it was a story about a cockfighting ring in Arkansas. But what it really ended up being was a story about ICE and the relationship in this small town between the community, the sheriff, and ICE agents. And so almost everybody that I interviewed in that story were undocumented and were, just sort of living day by day, nervous that they would be swept up and deported. So in that case, I got, permission to use pseudonyms for everybody to protect them, because nobody was going to talk to me without it. And there was no problem at all from the publication. And, for fact checking purposes, I recorded all my interviews. And the fact checkers were able to reach out to the people I talked to and knew their real names. And so as long as they can check the facts, they're okay. You know what I mean? If the person's name doesn't need to go in the story, they were fine with that. And the same would have been true for Spanky, but fortunately he was able to, he kind of got over that and was like, go ahead and use my name. I'm kicked out of every place anyway, so what does it matter? And it was a fun story because and this was Spanky's idea, man. I mean, Spanky, he put $150K in cash in a backpack and handed it to me, and he said, go in the oceans and start betting. I'm gonna tell you how to bet, and we'll see how quick before you get kicked out of there. And so it was like, it was nerve wracking for me, but it was fun to get to spend a day getting to pretend that I was sharp.
And how long did you last before they kicked you out?
Oh, I mean, they never kicked me out, but they limited me pretty fast. I mean, it took me just a few bets before. What was funny is when I first walked into the joint, I was like, do you guys take big bets? This was during the tournament, right? This was during March Madness. And I was like, do you guys take big bets? They were like, yeah, we'll take big bets. And I was like, well, do you have like a limit, like a maximum? And they were like, no, there's no maximum. You can bet as much as you want. Why would there be a maximum? They just thought I was there acting like I was crazy. I was like, okay, great. Can I get $10,000 in this game? And they're like, hold on a second. They get on the computer, like, we'll take five. So in the beginning, they were letting me bet 5,000. And so for a few bets, I was betting 5,000, and Spanky was like, maybe we just shouldn't do the story, because as long as they're going to let you bet $5,000, you maybe should just come work for me. But I think he was only half kidding. It didn't take long before they were done with letting me bet five, and then they were down to 1,000, and they were down to like 200. I mean, it was like, it was over the course of maybe a couple of hours. I mean, it was a lot of bets I was trying to make, but it didn't take very long at all before we'll take any amount. Turned into, we're only going to take $200.
Also on sports betting, you had an article in Esquire about New York sports bettors who go 3 feet into New Jersey, place their bets, and then go back into New York.
Yeah.
I found that was very interesting.
Yeah, that was another one where an editor reached out to me and was like, hey, will you write this story? And I was excited to get to write that one because it was something that I had been doing. I mean, I live in Nyack, New York, but I'm near the New Jersey border. And that was how I was betting. I would get in my car and drive 5 minutes right over the border and park my car in a parking lot and make bets. So I was already doing that when they sort of contacted me about this idea. But what I discovered after interviewing a lot of people was that platform at the Hoboken station was essentially a casino. I mean, it was just, and it was true. I mean, I just went down there over the course of a couple of weekends and would just sit on the platform and watch. Because, there'd be a crowd on the platform, and then everybody would get on their train, and then the trains would leave, and whoever was left on the platform were betting. It was just guys with their phones betting. Like, you just knew if someone's still standing on the platform when the train's gone, it's because they're gambling. And, a lot of people didn't want to talk to me, but, a lot of people did, and that was a fun story to write, too.
Seems like an ideal location to open a sports bar, right? Right over the border.
Definitely.
Definitely.
I mean, I think that, like, right now the sports book that's doing the biggest business is the Meadowlands. The brick and mortar sports book is doing the most business, the Meadowlands, because they just have a monopoly on all the New York City, market for people to just come right over. But Hoboken seems like a great place to do it. If they ever are able to legalize like what they have in the UK with like the kiosks and stuff, you'll just see them down there in the trains. The whole, if you go in the train station, it's just wrapped. It's completely wrapped in DraftKings posters and ads. Yeah. But I also wrote a story about Predict It, which I know is something you guys have been getting into lately. And it's one of your sponsors for your show. And, you know, that was another fun gambling story I did. And that one was one that I pitched because I had been playing on Predict It quite a bit and had found myself really addicted to it. And thought I should definitely write about this. And, you know, I guess a big part of why I've become a gambling writer is because I actually like to gamble. And the more I get obsessed with something, the more I think like, well, I should figure out how to write about this. Like if I'm really going to waste this much of my life and, you know, studying this and doing this, I might as well, like, you know, get a chance to write about it too. So Predict It was one of those things where I found myself on Predict It so much, you know, just constantly like reading through polls and trying to figure out good bets. And so I turned that into a story, and it ended up being a really fun story to write too. As I got to meet some of the real whales of Predict It, I realized how out of their league I really was and how I never had a shot at making big money like they did. But,
I saw an article by a guy who claimed that he made his living betting, politics and I guess mostly at Predict It. And we've tried to get him on the show, but so far, I haven't heard back. So if you have any connections from your story of guys who are making, big money betting politics, you know, if you wouldn't mind asking them if they'd be interested in coming on the show, we would love to get somebody on like that.
Yeah, I mean, some of the people I interviewed for my story probably they didn't even want to use their real names in the story. But the main guy, the guy they call Rainbow Jeremy that I talked about in my story, I think he doesn't mind the attention. And he's definitely a whale on Predict It. I mean, he moves a lot of money and moves markets and stuff. And he's a fascinating person. He'd be great for your show.
Oh, great. Well, if you can connect us, I'd appreciate it.
They exist just like with anything. I mean, there are predicted pros out there who are making, you know, Predict It has betting limits, so you can't get rich. You know what I mean? But you can make a living. I mean, you can definitely make.
Yeah. And you can, just like Spanky, you can get multiple accounts and.
Sure. But, you know, the thing about Predict It is that some of the better opportunities, there's not volume.
Yes.
You know, like you'll go in there and you'll say, oh, this price is ridiculous. But there's no shares that you can get. There's no volume. So there's not enough market makers, I guess, that's something I learned from hanging out with Spanky.
Yeah.
there's a lot of market takers and not a lot of market makers there yet. But yeah, people are definitely making money on that site. And it's fun. I mean, if you're already kind of obsessed with politics and you like gambling, then it's fun to figure out how to, you know, mix them together.
One of the stories I enjoyed reading has nothing to do with gambling, but it was about Harry Anderson, magician. He has this trick where he sticks his needle through his arm. So when you wrote about it, I had to see it. So I went to YouTube. And I'm sitting there in horror and I can't take my eyes away, and I simultaneously cannot look at it. And it was just fascinating. And I enjoyed that immensely. How well did you get to know him?
I met Harry Anderson one time. I've been a massive fan of his my whole life. I mean, you know, my grandparents, the woman who I wrote the book about, my grandmother, and then the man that she ends up marrying after the book, but who you meet right at the end of the book, you know, they were carnies. I mean, they traveled with the carnival. They ran, you know, scams, and they were, you know, they were kind of, you know, colorful carnival folks. And so I grew up really kind of like attracted to that world and to that kind of stuff. So when Harry Anderson in the 80s kind of hit the scene, you know, I was a kid, but he spoke right to me, you know, like I found him to be, you know, utterly captivating, not just because he was a magician, but his whole shtick, you know, his whole
persona.
Con artist persona. Yeah. I loved it. And so I was always a fan of his. I met him and he had moved to New Orleans prior to Katrina. He was living in New Orleans and he lived in the French Quarter, and he had a showroom, invitation only showroom called Spade and Archer, where he displayed his collection of carnival memorabilia that he had collected through the years. And I desperately wanted to see this stuff because I was very interested in, you know, kind of Carnival Obscurata and memorabilia. And I definitely wanted to see some of the stuff that I knew my grandparents had run. So I went to New Orleans, my girlfriend and I at the time, she's my wife now, but we went to New Orleans to try to see this stuff. And this is a bit of a long story, but I think it's a good one. I walked into a bookstore and I asked them if they knew where Spade and Archer was located because we couldn't find it. And right about then, Harry Anderson walked in, and this was maybe about 9:30 in the morning. And the woman at the store said, "Oh, they're asking about Spade and Archer." And he starts yelling at us. He's like, "Why the fuck are you asking them about Spade and Archer? You come into their business and you ask them about another business. Why don't you support them? Why don't you buy something from them?" And he's just spitting mad. So we felt guilty. So we started picking up books and stuff, and we bought some things and we left. And I was so crestfallen about it. So later that day, we're walking around the French Quarter, just sort of bummed that the whole thing was a bust. And I hear somebody say, "Hey, you." And I look, and a door is open. And inside of this house, Harry Anderson is sitting in this house. And he called us in there. And he said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry about before. I was still drunk from the night before. I was just I was just messing with you guys. I owned that store, too. You know, that was my store." And so he brought us in and he made us lunch. And we toured Spade and Archer. We went through his house. He showed us his collection. We spent the whole day with him. It was such a treat. And it's lucky that we ran into Blair that day, or I'd have spent the rest of my life hating his guts. But instead, I ended up kind of loving him even more. And so after he passed away, I quickly, you know, reached out to the Ringer and asked if I could write a remembrance of him because I was such a fan. And it was such a shock that he had died so suddenly. I was glad to get to write that and to sort of celebrate him a bit, because I think a lot of people only knew him as the judge from Night Court and didn't realize that he had this whole career as a magician, and that he, you know, that was his true love. I mean, he really, I think one of the things he talked a lot about was how his career as an actor, both on Night Court and then later on Dave's World, you know, that was just, he felt like he was, you know, that wasn't what he wanted to do. You know, he wanted to become a star for being, you know, a magician. And instead, he became a star for being a comedic character actor. And that, you know, I think it might have bothered him on some level that most of the people that knew him didn't even know the thing that he was truly great at.
Yeah, like you, I saw him in the beginning. He would come on Johnny Carson and shows like that, and do magic that usually was about gambling, three card Monty and things like that. And then they took that character and put him on Cheers. And that's how he got the spinoff to end up doing Night Court. But yeah, I was a big fan of his as well. You know, another thing you write quite a bit is chess. So are you a chess player?
I am. I'm a chess player, although I'm not great. But I have a son who's pretty good, plays, you know, scholastic chess competitively, and he's 10. He's been playing since he was 5. And, you know, I loved chess when I was growing up, and I played it in college, and I've always been a rec player, and I've studied it a little bit. But once I had kids and I started teaching my first child chess, then I got real into it, man. I mean, I became the sports parent with my son, but about chess, you know what I mean? Like the overbearing sports parent. That's kind of how I was about chess, unfortunately. And so I got really into chess over the last few years, just sort of teaching him and then taking him to tournaments and also kind of getting better myself at the game at the same time. So I wrote a story about that experience, you know, with my son. And then I got a chance to go to the World Chess Championships in London, and write about the World Chess Championships. It was a great experience. And I was excited to get to do that, but I think, you know, and they kind of gave me the real estate to write as much as I wanted. I think I wrote 10,000 words on it, but I love chess. I think I love games. I love, you know, games, period. But, you know, chess is definitely it's stood the test of time, right? It's definitely an elegant game, and it's addictive.
Yeah, I'm with you. When my sons were like 5 and 6 or 6 and 7, their school had these programs called after school enrichment programs, and I went to the principal and I said, you know, you should have chess. Like, this is so good for kids, right? I mean, the benefits are, they've done a lot of studies on the benefits of teaching young kids chess. And the principal said, you know what? I absolutely agree. When can you start teaching? And I was like, that wasn't my intent when I came here. So I got roped into teaching chess to six-year-olds, which is not easy. When you have a group of them, they don't like to sit in a chair for very long. So,
yep.
Actually, that's part of my background too. I taught a elective course on chess and mathematical games to seventh and eighth graders for a while. But on the World Series of chess, where that was the one where Magnus Carlsen took a draw in the last game on a position that he was a huge favorite, simply because he knew that the tiebreaker, he was a huge favorite. And so it impressed a lot of people as being an inelegant way to win the tournament. It impressed me as an advantage player as an extremely bright way to win a tournament. So,
Well, Magnus is a gambler, and he loves poker. And afterwards, you know, when he was, you know, criticized by some about that, he actually said, like, I'm going to take the plus EV play every time. So, you know, he actually talked about it in terms of expected value. And, that's how he was thinking about, you know, so it's one thing to be the best player at the world over the board in one particular game, but Magnus, I think part of his success, at least some small part of his success, is that not only is he such a dominant player, but he also is really good at thinking through the structure of the tournament and what's the best strategy for me to win. And we also saw sort of a variation on that theme this year, because during the pandemic, you know, chess has really blown up on online and on Twitch, and online chess is really exploding right now because we're all stuck at home and people are now turning to it. But Magnus organized his own tournament, which I also wrote about recently, and it's an online tournament, but he invited all the sort of top players to play in it with him, and he put up, you know, $250,000 as a prize pool. But he changed the rules and the structure and scoring system in such a way that it was a real radical departure from the way that most, you know, international top level chess tournaments are scored, which really shows how much Magnus thinks about that element of the game and how much that impacts the way people play and the decisions that they make.
The one thing I didn't understand about that, though, is chess has been just riddled with cheating scandals over the last number of years. And how are you going to have an online tournament and prevent people from cheating?
Well, it was a small tournament, number one, right? It was an invitation tournament. It was just the top players. And I mean, the short answer would be none of those players are going to cheat because they're all such strong players and they would be devastating their reputation. But there were quite a bit of cheating measures put into place. For example, they all had to screen share with the tournament arbitrators. So everybody's computer was screen sharing while they were playing. And they had software installed on all their computers, too, to make sure that they couldn't, you know, gimp around with that or open any other programs while they were playing. And there were cameras trained on them from multiple angles in their homes while they played. So the arbiters could watch them from different angles to see what they were doing. That's just a few of the things. There were other things that they didn't even tell me about that they kept secret because I guess they didn't want the players to know. But there were a number of things that they did to make that tournament, because it was so much money, make sure that everybody could feel confident nobody was cheating. But you're right. I mean, it's going to be impossible to ever have any kind of real money online tournaments, because any open tournaments for real money online, because people would be worried about cheating.
Yeah, one of the articles I liked was about Jimmy Canny, who, you know, there are these chess hustlers in New York that play in the park, and about this guy basically beating the chess hustlers, which I think it's always fun when the hustlers get out hustled by somebody. But one of the things I found interesting was after he had won a bunch of money, he started offering to spot them 5 minutes to 1 minute, right?
Yeah.
So they would have five minutes on their clock. He would only have one. And I remember the first time that someone offered me that spot, and I was thinking, this is impossible. How can they spot me 5-1 and still beat me? But yeah, they would just win every game. I mean, it was not even close.
I mean, chess is a great is actually a good gambling game, and it's not often seen as one. And it's, this game is pool, right? I mean, pool is a game where the most skillful player is going to win every time. But the reason pool is such a great gambling game is because you can negotiate a spot that can make any two players on earth, you know, be even if the spot is right. And so chess is similar. You can do that with the time controls. You can do that by taking pieces off the board. And so you see this in the park where people are playing for very little money. But chess is not a game where I think the top players find themselves gambling that often. I say that. I mean, I do know that there is quite a bit of gambling that goes on among Magnus and his cohort. And I know that during some of these online tournaments, there's a lot of side betting that goes on too. But I just think the general public doesn't think of chess as a gambling game when maybe they should, because I think that there are opportunities. And James, the guy that, wrote the that you're talking about, that story grandmaster, James Canty was, you know, he never really saw himself as a hustler. I mean, he definitely learned how to hustle a bit. But yeah, once people knew he was good, he would say, okay, well then let's just play and I'll give you the spot. But James now is my he's my son's chess coach, so that's so I still keep in touch with him, and he teaches my son chess every week.
Nice. Does he teach your son hustling?
You know, he hasn't yet. If we get Gus good enough, I'd be fine with paying a little bit of extra for him to teach Gus how to win some money. Might help pay for some of the lessons.
You have some podcasts in your near future, do you not?
Yeah, I'm currently putting a podcast together, and it's not, you know, it's as of yet untitled, and it'll probably come out in the fall if we can finish it. But I started working on a podcast that's about gamblers, and you know, the idea is to do a podcast that's narrative, you know, sort of a This American Lifestyle podcast, but to focus on the lives and the life and times of various gamblers, professional gamblers. And, you know, and my hope is that through the show to show that there are people who make their living at gambling at all walks of life. And I've even had to, you know, even with the producers of the show, this has been a hard thing for me to get them to understand that, like, I think that you guys probably run into this a lot, but like the general public, when they think of professional gamblers, they think that everybody that's a professional gambler must be some sort of high roller, you know, somebody playing poker on television, or like, you know, some multimillionaire like at a casino. But they don't realize that, like, being a professional gambler, that's just a job. I mean, there are people that are wealthy from doing it. There are people that eke out, you know, a decent, comfortable living doing it. And people gamble on all kinds of things, right? There's a lot more pro gambling than just people that gamble in casinos or play poker. And so I'm hoping that with this show, I can show that there's a very rich world out there of people who earn their living by playing games for money.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, I'm really proud of the fact that I think we've had people on this show talking about how to beat, I think, every single game in the casino, you know, including slot machines. And yeah,
lotteries.
Yeah.
And coupon hustling. And I mean, there's a lot of
It covers every. Yeah, you're right. And there are some people who are, you know, making minimum wage, but, you know, would rather be their own boss and do that than go work at McDonald's.
Yeah, and I also think that, like, for any game that you can name, there's some people play it for money, and the people who are the best at that game are playing it for money somewhere. It doesn't have to be a game that's considered a casino game or a gambling game, but if you're talking about golf, if you're talking about, you know, pool, if you're talking about, you know, I mean, whatever it is that people play, somebody out there who's really good at it has figured out a way to has found other people that'll play them for money. And that, I think, is maybe more what I'm interested in than anything, because as a games player, I like that. I like that, you know, there are folks out there who have mastered a game to the point where they're like, okay, now I'm ready to put my money where my mouth is.
All right, David Hill, this was extremely interesting. So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, they can come to my website, davidhillonline.com, and there's a form there where they can contact me. But I'm also very active on Twitter. My handle is DaveHill77. And unfortunately, I'm on there way too much, so that's also a good place to get my attention.
Very good. At the end of most of our shows, we have a recommended section. So, Richard, do you have something to recommend?
Well, besides David Hill's book, The Vapors, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Yes.
And his website. There, anybody who enjoys this show will find articles they will like at his website. But yes. As for what I've been binge watching recently, it's a show on Netflix called Marcella. And and the other thing that I was thinking about is for people who are interested in Oni Madden, you might also want to watch Boardwalk Empire, which is on HBO, and the movie, The Cotton Club, where he is the best character in the Cotton Club movie. So
Ed Asner.
Yeah.
Ed Asner.
No, no, it was Bob Hoskins, wasn't it?
Oh, Hoskins. I get those guys confused.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bob Hoskins.
So, thank you, Richard. And to make up for the fact that I do not have any recommended, I have coerced David into giving us a recommendation. So, David, what can you tell us?
Well, since you guys like chess, I'm going to recommend a chess book to you guys. It actually just came out today, same day as my book. But it's called The Best I Saw in Chess. Game Stories and Instruction from an Alabama Prodigy Who Became U.S. Champion. And it's written by a man named Stuart Rachels, who is a philosophy professor in Alabama, but was once upon a time the U.S. chess champion and was a child chess prodigy. And his father was James Rachels, who was a sort of a world-renowned philosopher and ethicist. And I met Stuart, interviewed him when I was writing my piece about the World Chess Championship, and just found him to be an utterly fascinating person. And I found him because I read a piece that his father had written years and years ago about questioning whether chess is art, which is a question that I'm also very obsessed with. So Stuart's book is just out today, The Best I Saw in Chess, and it's fantastic. And he's just, I think he's such a fascinating person. So if you like chess, you're interested in chess, and if you're interested in philosophy, I think you'll like this book.
And we will have links to all these, this in the show notes. And I just have to say, Bob, I know that you are an avid reader. So
yes,
for the last few weeks, you must have been reading all bad books because none of them are worth recommending.
Well, I've been reading a book called The Vapors, and I wouldn't call that a bad book.
Other than The Vapors, of course.
And I'm going to see if the publisher. Reading
Maria Konnikova's book. And so this actually, my job, so to speak, on doing the podcast involves reading a lot of books for our guests. And it's a mixed blessing. In this case, it was a strict blessing because I liked the book and I read it. But sometimes the books are a bit heavy going. But once we commit to doing it, we're going to do it. So this was fun. Thank you, David Hill, for joining us. We wish you success, continued writing on the on your podcast. It sounds like you and us could swap notes on who would be a good guest for both programs. It sounds like
I'll have to have both of you guys on.
Yeah,
I'm going to do a Bob Dancer episode for sure.
Okay, I'll practice that. That's good. That'd be fun. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.